It would be good to do so again, and it's going to take a little while. It's going to be a tough day for me and for you. We have this in Sunday school. I warned everybody on Facebook this morning. We've got this in Sunday school, and then I'm preaching both services, and we're dealing with how to map the moral, civil, and ceremonial laws in the Mosaic Code, and that's really difficult to do, so it's going to be a challenge. So I noticed that Ray brought extra coffee for his family. I warned everybody, bring your A-game attention spans, because this is going to be a challenge, but hopefully one that will be of use to you. Let's start off. Who has... Who has a ESV or we have Codex Ricketonius right here. We have the keeper of the Codex right here. I don't have my gloves on, but may I? This is Codex Ricketonius. We will be looking at a number of ancient manuscripts, this is definitely one of them, Codex Ricketonius. And it is definitely the earliest manuscript we have amongst us right now, with the keeper of the codex. Read for us John chapter. You can all look it up. Gospel of John chapter 5 verse 4. Look up Gospel of John chapter 5 verse 4. I thought he might have to wear special gloves when handling such ancient documents. I had to do that when I... That's probably just a glitch in your program, right? Right? So, do you have something for us, Brother Ricketts?
Well, it's missing from the oldest manuscript.
It's missing from the oldest manuscript in the room. Yes, yes.
It is
in a footnote. Yes, it is in a footnote. And now, if you have the King James or the New King James, you have it right there in the text. If you have the NIV, which is what Codex Ricketonius is a early exemplar of, New American Standard, I think, does NASB have it in brackets? Anybody have an NASB? Boy. It's not in brackets. But it's in the text? Okay, ESV doesn't have it, right? Footnote. Okay, all right. So, this is the kind of issue that causes people to ask questions. Now, there's all the information you could possibly ever need about John 5:4, right there. Clear to everybody? Probably not. Maybe to one or two in the room that have had the opportunity. But there's, of course, always someone who says it's all Greek to me. That's just the oldest, lamest joke in the book. I just sort of stand around waiting for somebody to make it so I can make fun of them. Yes, sir?
The NASB does have it in brackets. It starts
in 3, verse 3. Right. We will come back to look at this. One of the reasons I put that up there is just to point out to you that when we talk about these things, textual variations in the New Testament are not unknown to Christian scholars or ministers. If you go back into the earliest history of the church, there is great discussion of these issues. This is not something you will very often have people saying, well, people sweep this under the rug. And unfortunately, we help them with their accusations because of the fact that generally you will not have much in the way of discussion of these topics within the vast majority of evangelical churches. The reason for that is most ministers themselves are uncomfortable with the subject. It's not a subject that is necessarily focused upon. Even if they took a lot of Greek, it's generally not dealt with in a real in-depth way. So we sort of help. But the reality is that certainly Christian scholarship has dealt with this issue for a very, 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 very long time. Now, the reality is, as we all know, yeah, it depends. Well, we don't need to turn that one off, I don't think. Yeah, it's pretty close. You know, if folks up here are taking notes, they've got enough light. I think everybody up here okay? Okay, all right. We know that naturalistic materialism rules the day in academia. If you can't put it under a microscope, if you can't weigh it, then it simply doesn't exist. And anything that does not presuppose an uncreated universe that can be explained solely on the basis of naturalism is rejected a priori. Christian claims, such as that of inspiration, et cetera, are relegated to the arena of myth. Now, I tried to go get the cart this morning. It's all hooked up with a big old TV on top of it, and I just did not have time to unhook it. So I do not have extra speakers. And so I do not know if I'm going to be able to play my videos and anybody be able to hear it. I suppose if we're quiet enough, maybe if I turn the fan off, or the overhead fan there, it might help. But I'm going to try a clip here, and we will see if it's going to be loud enough to be heard. We might all have to just stop breathing for a second. But let's see if this let's see if this works. Okay, so there's, I don't think we're going to be able to see this. Yeah, that's just not going to be loud enough. There you had Bart Ehrman on, sadly, one of the sources of news for the younger generation, talking about how all we have are copies of copies of copies of copies. We don't know what it originally said. Notice he said, in some places. I think he'd probably limit that to maybe a dozen places in the entirety of the New Testament. But be it as it may, that's the kind of presentation that is being made all across our land, all across the English-speaking world. Believe me, Bart Ehrman is the favorite apostate Christian of all Muslim apologists in the world, who liberally quote him with regularity. And so this is what we're facing. This is what our young people are facing in universities, community colleges, high schools, and junior high schools anymore for that matter. Not just in the realms of quote-unquote higher learning. And so what we have is we have scholars spinning the evidence, particularly in media appearances. They emphasize that all we have are copies of copies of copies from hundreds of years after the originals. Now, those of you who have seen this, I would appreciate if you would not ruin the presentation by answering all the questions ahead of time. That is unfair, unkind, and possible grounds of church discipline. Given that we have approximately 5,771, that's an approximation, right? That could change next week, especially due to the fact that Dan Wallace and the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts is out in the field photographing manuscripts, and hence they're constantly finding new ones, or they're finding out the one that they're photographing is actually part of one that we knew previously, and so the number goes up and down as they're doing this kind of work. But assuming the current number of 5,771 handwritten Greek manuscripts. Now, when I talk about a handwritten Greek manuscript, we're talking about from the earliest that we have all the way through the age of printing, even as late as the 17th century, because it took a while for printing to catch on, basically. You didn't just have a sudden proliferation of printing presses and so on and so forth. But all those manuscripts are not necessarily of the entirety of the New Testament. Some are just fragments. Some contain the entire New Testament. Keeping that in mind, 5,771 cataloged manuscripts at this point in time. How many variants? Now, what is a variant? A variant is any place where one manuscript reads differently from another. It can be word order, it can be spelling, it can be including a verse, not including a verse, including a word, not including a word, having a word before another word. Anything like that amounts to a variant, a single variant. How many variants do you think, and if you know, again, please allow others who have not studied this yet to experience the joy or the terror, depending on how you want to look at it. How many variants do you think would be represented in those 5,771 handwritten manuscripts? You're all sitting there going, we've already seen this before, so we're not going to say a word. Yes, sir. I don't know, but maybe 400,000. Yeah. Okay. Who whispered? Who held the sign up? Yeah. Okay. So it is approximately 400,000. Yes. Ruined that. It is interesting because normally, the last time I gave this presentation, for example, I gave it in Norway over about four nights. I will get guesses from like 5 to 100. 5 to 100 as the number of variants. And when you just think about 5,771 handwritten documents, and I've always wanted to do this. I haven't ever done it, but it would be fascinating to hand out or just use the bulletin and have the first row here copy the bulletin and then give their copies to the next row and have the next row copy the bulletin and all the way on to the back of the room and then see how many variants develop by the time we get to the back of the room. It normally takes way too much time because most of us can't copy very fast and in fact most of us do so little handwriting anymore that our hands start cramping up after a very short period of time. But it is interesting that the numbers are rarely high. They're almost always very low. But there are about 400,000 variants. Now there are, in the Nestle-Aland 27th edition, there are 138,162 words. I think the Nestle-Aland 28th is like 108,200 something. So there's a few more in that particular edition. But you'll be told that's nearly three variants per word. Because think about it, if you only got 138,000 words, you got 400,000 variants, then what you're told is that's three options for every word. Now, that's not what it is, but that's how it's explained. And if you're talking with someone who has said, well, look, you know, I took classes from so-and-so at Arizona State University, and they told me this. What they've probably been told is something along the lines of what I'm presenting to you. And so one of the biggest challenges for us is to take somebody who has been given a warped view, even if it's based on some facts, and tell the truth to them and disabuse them of their confusion. But the only way that we can disabuse someone of their confusion is to know what the facts are ourselves. And unfortunately, one of the reasons a lot of Christians don't know this is because they're too scared to face the reality of the history of their text. And that actually ends up really being a very, very bad thing. So we're confidently told no one can have any confidence that the text they read today accurately reflects what was originally written. And in fact, you'll see like graphics like this. The blue there is the number of words in the New Testament. And then the red here is the number of variants. And so, man, that looks like the New Testament text is just hopelessly corrupted, and we could never really know what it originally said. But what I'm going to tell you over the next few weeks is what they don't tell you and what you need to know and what you need to be able to explain to someone else. First of all, 99% of all variants do not impact the meaning of the text. Variations in spelling and word order make up the vast bulk of the textual variants. So what I mean by that is that in the vast majority of instances, unless you actually read the Greek language, you would not be able to understand what the variation was because it does not translate into another language. The most common example of this, because it's the most common textual variant, I can't come up with other good examples other than this one because it's the most common one. In the English language, you are supposed to say an apple, an abacus, an elephant. You're supposed to have an N rather than a apple or a abacus to break up the vowels for pronunciation purposes. Well, Greek had the same concept, and it was called a movable U. And a lot of first-year Greek students just really do not like the movable new. And a lot of the scribes who copied the New Testament over the many centuries also did not like the movable new, did not quite understand its purpose and its function. And so whether you say a apple or an apple doesn't change the meaning. It's just whether someone's going to give you a job or not, I suppose. Well, unless you're down south, and that doesn't make any difference at all. So there's a huge number of the variations are along those lines. So whether you spell Capernaum one way or Capernaum another way. So spelling issues like that. And, of course, there were a number of different ways to spell many of the ancient cities. The idea of standardized spelling is a modern thing. Now, young people, you can't use that as an excuse to not work on your spelling. But it is a modern thing. And, in fact, most of you are probably aware of the fact that John Wycliffe spelled his own name 12 different ways in documents that we possess today. So the idea of standardization, new idea. So if there's different spellings in the New Testament by scribes down to the ages, that's hardly relevant and does not exactly help us. So, when you think about it, yes, sir?
So, there are people who have sat down for years, people watching over their shoulders, and they have counted approximately 400 times.
This is...
They have documented a 99%
No. It's not a computer readout because, like I said, even the number of manuscripts continues to change every day. This is based upon looking at the manuscripts that have been thoroughly analyzed and looking at the number of variations from the standardized text and extended out from there. There is no possible way as yet. It's going to change, but there is no possible way as yet for any kind of encyclopedic analysis of all New Testament manuscripts because we just don't have access to them. In fact, that's one of the big issues that Dan Wallace and CSNTM has.
Well, of the existing manuscripts, the existing ones that we have, the 5,771,
and
we have
selections,
we have none.
No. Okay, like I said, it's you take the manuscripts that you do have full access to, and you can do this in, and mathematically extending out from the number of variants you found in the ones that you have, the ones that you have not as yet have that kind of full access to. See, we've lost manuscripts in Iraq, for example, just over the past decade. There have been museums in Iraq that have been trashed by ISIS. They're gone. And that's why CSNTM is so focused upon going around the world and taking high-quality digital photography so it can be stored in the cloud so that, if, you know, war and so on and so forth doesn't rob from us some of the greatest, treasures that we have. So, this is based upon extending out from what we have been able to do. Now, interestingly enough, of all works of antiquity, this is the most studied work of antiquity. But the problem is we have more evidence for this particular document than for any other work of antiquity. We'll talk about that later on. And so there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. But more work has been done on this than anybody else. So there just isn't a whole lot of money in this either. Let's just be, you have to pay people and they have to be highly trained and it's difficult to do. So the 400,000 number is an approximation, as is the 99%. It could be 98%, whatever. We do know, however, that if you take 1% of 400,000, you get 4,000 meaningful textual variants out of 138,162 words, is 2.9% or one meaningful variant every three pages. But only half of these are viable. Now, what does this term viable mean? Well, I've used the illustration a number of times. Let's say in the year 1279, Monk Bob one morning, and Monk Bob is now in his late 40s, and Monk Bob, his like most of us who are past that age ourselves, realize that our arms keep getting shorter and shorter, and it's very difficult to see things close up anymore. And remember, this is 1279, so the idea of progressive lenses or anything else is yet future. And so Monk Bob can't see as well as you. And Monk Bob gets up one morning and for some reason on his way into the monastery, Starbucks is closed. So he can't get his morning fix of caffeine. When he got out of bed, for some reason, his kitty cat was in the wrong place, and he tripped over the kitty cat and stubbed his toe, and he just had a rough morning, okay? And so he gets into his job of copying manuscripts, and it's a cloudy day, and it's not as bright as it could be, and he's not seeing so well, and he's not feeling so well because he didn't sleep well, and now he didn't get his coffee, and his toe is throbbing, and so he's a little distracted. And so Monk Bob doesn't pay attention to what he's doing, and he comes up with a reading in the manuscript he's copying, because his mind's a million miles away, that no one has ever seen before. No one's ever seen this reading before. He just completely flubs it. Now, hundreds of years later, we find Monk Bob's manuscript in a dusty corner of an old library in Europe someplace. And we go, here's a variation. And it is a variant. But since it's never been seen in any other manuscript anywhere, it's not in any of the early translations of the New Testament, it's not in any of the manuscripts in the area around which Bob's was copied, it's all alone. We would not say that it is viable, that is, that it could be the original reading. So, when you look at the number of variants we have, less than half of them are actually the meaningful ones that actually impact the meaning of the text. Less than half of them are viable or could actually go back and be the original. And so what you then have is about 1,500 to 2,000 viable, meaningful New Testament textual variants. And so, if you any Greek New Testaments in the room today, other than they're all appearing on phones now. People used to be holding up their Nestle Allen text or the UBS text or stuff like that. But if you look at a printed edition of the Greek New Testament, you will see down at the bottom of the page these notes. And I remember distinctly, I was talking with my Greek professor about it just this this past weekend, weekend before this, I remember the day. I remember where I was sitting, which direction I was facing, what room I was in Fleming Classroom Building at Grand Canyon College. When we open up the Greek New Testament and I'm looking at the page, I put my hand up and I say, "Dr. Baird, what are these notes down at the bottom of the page?" And he says, "Well, that's where the Greek manuscripts differ from one another." And I was already witnessing to Mormons and so on and so forth, and I knew as soon as he said that, that's important stuff. And that's why I was, he will tell you, he's told me in years since then, he said, after about 3 years, you're already so far beyond me in textual critical stuff, it wasn't even funny, I just couldn't tell you that. So, I dove into that stuff and really recognized the importance. So, you've got about 1,500 to 2,000 viable, meaningful New Testament textual variants. And so let's take a look at that graphic we had before. Now, here's the number of words, and there's the number of meaningful variants. Obviously, that's a very different picture than what we were looking at before. Now, think with me for a moment. The more manuscripts you have for a particular work, the more you will have. If all we had was Codex Ricketonius, if that's all we had, how many textual variants would we have? None. Because we have nothing to compare it to. Now, a lot of people want to be told we have no textual variants. But what is the cost? Because think about it. What if that's all we had? That's not a lot, is it? And if all you have is one manuscript, then what must be true? That one manuscript perfectly represents the original. Because if you got nothing else, there's no way you can find out one way or the other. So there are a lot of people that would like to have it to where, you know, we have this, the holy place on the mountain. And the special Bible monks have been there. And they're like the Muslim dude in The Mummy, you know, that, you know, they're there with their big swords and they're defending the one manuscript and against all sorts of monsters and stuff, whatever. And if we want to know, then we have to go to the mountain and there's the one, you know, and we'd have no questions. Really? Would we have no questions? Of course not. We'd have all sorts of questions. If that was the only manuscript we had, then can you hear the critics? Well, what do you think those monks have been doing up there all this time? I mean, seriously, how do you know they haven't changed anything? And we'd have no way of knowing. The only other way around it would be what? Chisel it in stone. Now, that really doesn't work well for evangelism, you know, spreading the gospel around the world. You know, we all have to go to this one mountain and reference stuff that's chiseled in stone. But that would be about the only other way around the issue that we're discussing, and that is, if you want a written communication, an oral communication, a written communication, if you want communication language to be portable and translatable, then these are the issues you have to deal with, and every work of antiquity has the same issues that we're talking about. And we'll compare the New Testament with these later on. So the more manuscripts you have, the more variants you're going to have. Because once you have two manuscripts, okay, there's some difference between the two. Once you have three, there's more. Once you have four, there's more. But what is better? And this is, since I have the clip, I need to remind myself to stick this in. But just this week, I'm going to be speaking a week from tomorrow at the Masters Academy International Symposium in California on inerrancy in the global church. And one of the clips that I put together was one of my Muslim friends, Adnan Rashid. And Adnan and I did a debate on the transmission of the New Testament text at a Baptist church in London a few years ago. And at one point he gets up and he says, James says that the free transmission of the New Testament text is one of the greatest evidences of its reliability. He says, that's the biggest blunder I've ever heard in my life. How can having thousands of people copying the manuscripts and making mistakes give you more certainty than what we have with the Quran? And he just doesn't understand. He's not thought it through. We need to think it through, because it's easy to go, that does sound weird. I mean, how could you say that having more manuscripts? But then you really start thinking about it, like, well, yeah, the more you have, then the more you can correct any one person's errors. So if you have Monk Bob, but then you have Monk Jorge, and he's actually very good, then if you have 10 Jorges to one Bob, they're going to give you all the evidence you need to see where Bob messed up. The more you have, the more you can compare with one another and see the common types of scribal errors that are made. And so the reality is, the more you got, the better. It does end up being, we have so much that it's difficult to collate all the information, but that's unusual. I mean, the New Testament is so far beyond any other work of antiquity, it's not even funny. Yes, sir?
Well, that was kind of along.
You want me to say the word Jorge? Yeah, that helped too? Okay, all right.
Any other ancient document, obviously, but the next ancient document under this type of microscope, what is the very
Well, Homer is the next, and I've got a really cool graphic I'll show you later on that. But there's nothing in the New Testament's family at this point, because the average, I mentioned this last week, the average amount of time, at least I think I mentioned it last week, I don't know, the average amount of time between when a work of antiquity was written and our first manuscript evidence of it is between 500 and 900 years. For Homer, Suetonius, Pliny, Plato, etc., etc. For the New Testament, we're talking 100 years. So nobody's even in the same family. You're talking, who knows what happened in 500 to 900 years. We've only got 100 years. So there's nobody even in the same family to compare it to. It's so far beyond any of that. Yes, ma'am. Because it's a handwritten manuscript of the New Testament in Greek. And some of them are quite honestly irrelevant, because some of them are actually handwritten copies of printed texts. So there's a set of, you know, probably 50 that really, they're cataloged because they're handwritten copies in the New Testament, but they're pretty much irrelevant. Even though I could tell you some interesting stories about that, but we'll get into that. Okay, so let's make sure we all understand this part. As I mentioned, more than 5,700 catalog manuscripts, New Testament, average which is 350 pages long. That is over 2 million pages of text, grand total. So 1,500 to 2,000 meaningful and viable variants, over 2 million pages of hand-copied text spanning approximately 1,500 years, maybe even a little more, prior to the invention of printing, is an amazingly small percentage of text reflecting an amazingly accurate history of transmission. One might say it is downright miraculous. Now, the funny thing is, even though Bart Ehrman doesn't make his money saying this, he would not disagree with the vast majority of what it has said. He might say it's 98% or 97%, or he'd probably just simply say, we don't know the exact percentage. But he will admit that the vast majority of textual variations have nothing to do with transmission of the text. And when people say, so, I mean, I'll never forget, he was on an atheist program, and the atheists were so excited to have him on. So one of the atheists said, so, Dr. Ehrman, after all this stuff about all the variation stuff, what do you think the New Testament was originally about? And Bart Ehrman's like, about Jesus, the Son of God, and salvation? And they're like, huh? He says, well, we know what the New Testament was about. See, they think that what he's talking about is this massive amount of variation, and it was really originally about a sun god from Jupiter or whatever. And the reality is, when I debated him and I asked him in cross-examination, could you show us anywhere in the New Testament where you feel that we do not have any longer in any manuscript the original reading? He can only point to one place where there's no textual variant at all, where it's the difference between in also or the word Enoch, Enochi, which has zero meaning as far as any type of theology or anything else. One place. That's all you come up with. So the atheists are like, it was like popping a balloon. You know, and they're all really disappointed and sad and so on and so forth. Yes, sir?
Is there a set formula that everyone can use even to acknowledge the truth that textbooks and history and...
No, we might get into, once we've laid the foundation, we might add some variations and work through some of that, but no, there are certain principles, but no, there's no one big guru thing. Real quickly here, because, man, this goes fast. A few years ago, I asked the computer to compare for me the two most dissimilar printed Greek texts that we possess today. For those of you who are interested, this would be a comparison of the Westcott and Hort text from 1881 with the majority text, the Byzantine, maybe TR. So Byzantine versus Alexandrian, basically. And to mark the differences in green. And so here's Ephesians chapter 1, verses 1 through 14. And so you'll notice that there are... Here's place green, 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 there, and there's a little teeny one right there, which is actually the most important textual variant in Ephesians 1, 1 through 14. Right here, it's the difference between ha and has, whether the spirit is identified with a masculine or a neuter pronoun. Neuter would actually be formally correct, because pneuma is a neuter noun, but... if it's hos, then it's similar to what we have in John, where the masculine pronoun is used to emphasize the personality of the Spirit. But the point is, when you hear someone saying, well, there's three options for every word in the New Testament, then you look at this, you go, no, I would say the vast majority of that, there's no variation in whatsoever. So you look at this, and just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, that we might be holy and blameless before him in love. There really isn't any logical, rational, historical basis for anyone to question that is exactly what the original reading of Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4 was. And even in the verse above, where there's a minor variant right here, those of you that read Greek, you know that's preposition meaning in and or by, depending on how you interpret it. And you know that in Greek, Christo is in the locative instrumental dative case by its form. And so you don't necessarily have to have the preposition. You'd still have to translate it in light of the form of the word anyways. And so when you look at that, you see just how ridiculous it is when people try to say, well... You know, we don't have any idea what the New Testament originally said. The extent of variation is considerably less than, unfortunately, people like to make it look when they use the big numbers and don't break it down into the reality. Unfortunately, our time is up and we have to shift gears massively for the next hour, as do I. So your prayer is appreciated. Let's close with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this time. As quickly as it's gone by, we ask that you would help us to understand these things, that we would remember from week to week so that we might put this information together, we might be used of you to give an answer for the faith that's within us, the hope that's within us, Lord, that you might use us to cast light in this dark world. We pray in Christ's name. Amen. Thank you.
Have a great day.